It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on this week's edition of Food Friday, legendary chef Jacques Pepin is back with a new book featuring recipes and his own paintings featuring chicken. First, October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. The month is meant to raise money and increase public awareness of the most common cancer among American women. But for some breast cancer survivors, October can be a difficult time with constant reminders of a traumatic period in their lives. We're talking about Breast Cancer Awareness Month and how it can impact survivors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone close to you had breast cancer? How do you feel about Breast Cancer Awareness Month? Are you glad to see that awareness out there? You have mixed feelings, maybe, about being reminded of a tough time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Holly Burns is a freelance journalist and regular contributor to the New York Times, where she writes about wellness and relationships. Holly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
You wrote about this recently. Holly, you're a breast cancer survivor yourself. Would you be willing to share a little bit about your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was diagnosed with breast cancer in November 2017. I was 37 and I had just had my second child. She was just 5 months old. So it came as quite the shock. I don't have any family history. I had no indication, obviously, that it would be something that happened to me. And I'm coming up now on, 5 years since it happened. So it's receded a little bit in the past, but I do find every October, it kind of brings a whole host of feelings up again. And so I wanted to write the piece for the New York Times to find out if other people felt the same way, which it turned out that a lot of the women I spoke to did. And to kind of just let people know that, if you do feel like this, you're not alone.
Can you talk about that? Both you and some of the people you talk to, what kind of things does seeing all the awareness, the pink ribbons and things like that, what kind of things end up being called to mind?
Sure. Yeah. There's several pieces of it. And I think for the majority of women I spoke to and for me as well, it's just this very present reminder. I've sort of glibly joked to friends that I don't like Breast Cancer Awareness Month because I'm very aware of my own breast cancer. Thank you. But it's more than that. It's, I think, as a survivor or even as somebody who hasn't gone through breast cancer themselves, but has had somebody in their lives who has, you're kind of always worried about it coming back and, it does get better with time and it does recede a little bit, but then something like an entire month dedicated to the very worst thing that ever happened to you, it kind of just throws it all back in your face. And, you've tried to get some distance from it and suddenly it's constantly in your inbox or you can't walk into the grocery store without, seeing pink cookies and stuff. So I think just sort of the reminder of it is difficult for a lot of people. And I think also there's an aspect of this idea of awareness can sometimes feel, and not always, and I also want to preface this by saying that this is my experience and the experience of some of the people I spoke to, and I obviously don't speak for everyone who's gone through this treatment or experienced this, but some of the awareness I think can feel quite performative. And I think some companies kind of see this month almost as a sort of a seasonal thing. They've got our Labor Day sale, and then our Breast Cancer Awareness Month promotion, then our Halloween, and then our Thanksgiving. And even as a journalist, I've had pitches for stories around Breast Cancer Awareness Month that start, "Hi Holly, Happy Breast Cancer Awareness Month." And I think it's just like read the room. And I think that some companies kind of see this maybe as sort of carte blanche to kind of glom onto this idea of breast cancer awareness and use it as a marketing tool. And I think for those of us who have been affected by the disease and who have had terrible experiences that are related to it, that it can be quite difficult to sort of see that used as a marketing tool. And then I think just the last thing is that often breast cancer is presented, particularly during October, as a monolith, that it's just this, it reduces it to this one experience. And I think that it isn't, obviously, one disease with one story and one treatment. It's so much more nuanced than that. And I think that, it can be hard to see a story being upheld as breast cancer awareness, fodder when that isn't maybe your story. Right. And I think that can be difficult sometimes
I wanted to ask about that in particular. A lot of times we see like the positive, you powered through and you did it and you got through breast cancer. And for some people, that's depending on the kind of breast cancer, that's not going to be the reality, right?
Exactly. And that is something that I found speaking to some women who had, you know, who were later stage patients, that, you know, they felt that only the happy narratives are presented, and, you know, the story of I went through it, and, you know, I had treatment, and I, you know, I learned these lessons, or it gave me this perspective, and it's sort of this like redemptive narrative almost, that it isn't real. And I think that for a lot of women, it isn't real. And I think that there is so much less of a spotlight on other stories, like, you know, the fear of recurrence that is often with you, or, you know, women who are living with stage 4 metastatic cancer, women dealing with that, I think it makes them feel less seen because their stories are presented less often.
Talking to Holly Burns, she wrote about Breast Cancer Awareness Month for the New York Times and the sometimes at best mixed feelings that breast cancer survivors like herself feel when that month comes along and reminds them of what might be the most difficult, maybe even traumatic experience of their lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Holly, I hope that most people who have experienced breast cancer have supportive people around them, supportive and well-meaning people around them. Based on your experience and the women you talk to about breast cancer, what kind of advice would you share for those of us, you know, come looking in from the outside and wanting to say and do helpful things?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question, and I love that you're asking that. I think just for me, and then this was echoed also in a lot of the women I spoke to, a really helpful thing is just a very simple, you know, reaching out to somebody who you know might be finding this month hard, and just saying, you know, hey, like, I just want to acknowledge this. I know that this might be difficult for you. And again, as I say, maybe it isn't. Maybe some women do like it, and they like, you know, the focus on awareness is so important, of course. But a lot of us, I think, do find it quite distressing and quite difficult. And I have found it very helpful when friends have just said, you know, hey, hope you're okay. Hope you're hanging in there. That has been very, very helpful for me. Just a quick text.
Do you have thoughts on how, you know, when businesses and public groups and nonprofits and fundraisers are trying to do, again, well-meaning good stuff during this month, do you have thoughts for them on how to do it in a way that maybe isn't so in your face, it isn't giving weirdly positive messages?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know that I'm no sort of marketing genius. I don't know that I'm equipped to give advice on that, but I'll tell a story that, you know, before I had been diagnosed, I hadn't honestly given a ton of thought to Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Obviously, I had noticed it, but it didn't have a personal relevance to me. So it wasn't something that I had been aware of. And then the first October, October 2018, so a year after I had been diagnosed, I got an email from a shoe company whose emails I got, and they were running a promotion for October where they were asking people to nominate a breast cancer survivor, and they'd send them a pair of pink shoes. And it troubled me because I thought, you know, what if these people don't want their stories told for this company's marketing purposes? You know, what if they don't want a pink pair of shoes? Pink is so intertwined with breast cancer. What if they don't want to look down at their shoes and, you know, be reminded of this? And then also, how is this even helping? There was no donation or anything made. And so I kind of, you know, I thought about this, and it sort of bothered me, and it troubled me enough that I wrote the company a few emails. I didn't hear back. Through a friend of a friend of a friend, I somehow wrangled a phone call with the CEO of the company, and I was able to explain this to her. And I just, you know, I wanted to put a real person in front of her and explain why this, you know, might be sort of a problematic campaign. And she was extremely receptive. She listened so well. And then a few weeks later, she sent me an email, you know, thanking me for the feedback and telling me that the company was making a $22,000 donation to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, which I thought was incredible. Obviously, that is, you know, not something that everybody can do every time, but it felt good to kind of channel my frustration into something that was going to help people. And I guess I would say that, kind of, you know, put your money where your mouth is, like, make a donation. Don't just sell pink cookies, or, you know, have your sports team wear pink socks or whatever, but make a donation to, you know, to a research based foundation that will actually be helping people.
And as we wrap up, Holly, if someone's listening who is experienced or is currently dealing with breast cancer, and they're nodding as you talk to, yeah, this stuff is kind of bringing me down, do you have thoughts for them?
Absolutely. I mean, I just want to say, first of all, you're not alone. It was very validating to me in writing this piece that I discovered that I wasn't alone, and that many other people did feel this way. So I would just say, first of all, you know, it's a totally valid way to feel, and many of us feel this way too. And then also, you know, some of the quick things that people I spoke with did is, you know, you can set up filters on your email and social media so that you're not seeing breast cancer related stuff. One woman that I interviewed, she did all her grocery shopping online for October, so she wasn't, you know, knocked in the face by you know, pink Oreos and pink hummus and all the other trappings of the month. And then I think I just want to reiterate the point that you know, we've only got 11 days left of October. I have found for me, it gets easier every year. And again, you know, you're not alone.
Holly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Holly Burns, a journalist, regular contributor to the New York Times, where she writes about wellness and relationships. She talked to us about her experience during Breast Cancer Awareness Month as a survivor. Coming up, we'll talk to a clinical psychologist who works with, among other people, breast cancer patients. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a breast cancer patient or survivor? How has that affected, as you see it, your mental health? Is there something that helped you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about why October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, can be a tough time for survivors. And we're going to look at the broader psychological impact of having breast cancer, going through treatment. It can be traumatic. One study found that nearly a quarter of women who'd recently been diagnosed had post-traumatic stress disorder. Kathleen Ashton is a board-certified clinical health psychologist in the Breast Center, Digestive Disease, and Surgery Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. Kathleen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you work with patients going through breast cancer treatment. Have they had similar experiences to our previous guest as they go through Breast Cancer Awareness Month and get these constant reminders of what they're dealing with?
I would say about 95% of my patients who are breast cancer survivors have a similar reaction to Holly, in that this is their least favorite month. There's a few people who really embrace it, but I would say for the majority of patients, it can cause some distress.
And we got some advice from Holly for people in that situation. What do you recommend for the patients you are working with if they're having a tough time during October?
I think Holly has some really good advice. I would limit your social media. I would educate your family and friends about what's most helpful to you this month. You know, many of them may feel like they're celebrating you by wearing something pink or shouting you out on social media. So just provide them with that feedback about how it affects you very honestly. And I would definitely do something nice to take care of yourself. You know, I think that Breast Cancer Awareness Month is great for raising awareness about screening, but for actual survivors, maybe it could be a signal to kind of do something for their self-care in a way that they're in charge of.
Stepping away from the Awareness Month in particular, can you talk about some of the mental and emotional health challenges that might face someone going through breast cancer treatment and afterwards?
There are so many different psychological aspects of going through breast cancer. So when you're initially in treatment, there is just coping with that initial diagnosis and hearing the C word and cancer. There's lots of anxiety and fear, as well as just the stress of going through the actual treatments. There can be a lot of body image changes. When you think about a mastectomy or hair loss or weight gain, that's common with chemotherapy. And then there's really a lot of long-term psychological impact for patients well into survivorship that I think the public's probably not aware of. So women who are breast cancer survivors, even when they're finished with their active treatment, may still have fatigue. They may still have fear of recurrence. They can often have some ongoing insomnia or depression. So it doesn't stop just after surgery or chemotherapy. A lot of patients have some long-standing issues from their breast cancer that they're continuing to cope with.
I wanted to ask you about coping with that fear of recurrence, a very reasonable and rational concern, I think, for somebody who's been through any kind of cancer. How do you talk to people about living with that kind of hanging over their heads?
Yeah, we think that about 70% of breast cancer survivors have what we call clinical fear of recurrence. And as you mentioned, some of them even a post-traumatic stress reaction. There are some really good treatments out there for fear of recurrence, but it is important to acknowledge that that is a very real concern. So the treatment's a little bit different than your standard cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety. It includes a lot of acceptance strategies, a lot of working with their doctors about what the facts are about their particular cancer. and learning just different strategies to manage that anxiety, acknowledge it while not letting it take over their life.
And Kathleen, you work directly with the patients themselves, as I understand it, but do you have some thoughts for, you know, if it's somebody in our family, if it's somebody in our group of friends or even coworkers, what can that that nearby community do to be supportive?
I think that really asking patients for what would be most helpful to them is really important, not assuming that they're excited that it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but maybe just checking in with them, saying, I've heard it can be a difficult month, and seeing how they're doing. It can also just be very helpful to think about doing something meaningful, a donation to a research foundation. I would particularly put a plug in for donating for research for metastatic breast cancer. This month is often seen as the happy pink cancer month, but women who have metastatic breast cancer are pretty aware that breast cancer is probably going to be the thing that causes their death. And there's really not enough research money going towards those folks. So if we could put in a plug for research dollars for those patients, I think that would be great.
We're talking to Kathleen Ashton, board certified clinical health psychologist in the Breast Center Digestive Disease and Surgery Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. We're looking at not just the physical, but the psychological, the mental health impact of going through breast cancer treatment and surviving it that can last a long time after the treatment. Kathleen, you're a psychologist who works with people going through these physical ailments. It seems like, I don't know, I think about this a lot. People go through a difficult medical event and they don't get the kind of treatment you're providing. These are things that can cause depression and trauma and other consequences. Do we need more of this kind of thing in this country?
We absolutely need more of it. I'm so lucky to be at the Cleveland Clinic. Our program values psychologists and social workers as part of the team. And it gives us the chance to provide this kind of care to patients and treat them as a whole, their physical and their mental health. I think we're seeing a real need for mental health care in general in this country, but particularly when you're going through a major medical issue, psychologists can be a really nice part of your team.
If there's somebody listening thinking, you know, I'm going through treatment, I just went through treatment, I didn't have access to this kind of psychological treatment, what kind of advice would you offer them? What kind of suggestions would you have them to even just acknowledge that this takes an emotional and mental health toll?
Yeah, I think it's good to think about how is this affecting you, right? Think about your sleep and your appetite and your mood, how it's affecting your functioning in your life. If you're seeing a big impact, you know, if you don't have a psychologist as a member of your medical team, ask your oncologist if they refer out to someone in a private practice. Really think about what else you can do for your self-care. There's certainly lots of natural remedies, including things like exercise and meditation. You know, talk to your family physician about, you know, do I need an antidepressant? There's lots of ways to get mental health care. It's good to have that awareness first off.
Are there resources out there, whether online or support groups or whatever, that that can help patients, survivors, and caregivers?
There's lots of resources out there. I'm always a little cautious about support groups because they certainly can cause sometimes more anxiety than they help with. So you just have to find the right one for you. You know, if it's something that you find helpful, absolutely go for it. And support groups are available through social media and other outlets. I definitely would recommend cancer support networks in your community that often have more moderated support groups and services that are free to cancer patients. So if you just look up Cancer Support Network, you may find some local resources there as well.
We've mostly been talking about breast cancer survivors here. You mentioned that you work with people, you know, just after they receive this, the C word, the cancer diagnosis. For somebody who might be going through that right now, what kind of things do you offer? What kind of things do you tell the patients you're working with in that moment?
You know, I think it's important to draw on your strengths. So think about what in your world will really help you to cope with this. And that might be your spirituality, that might be your support system, it might be a really healthy lifestyle. And I think then, you know, to look at adding a few more tools to your toolbox as you go along with the disease is important. So it might be learning how to do a deep breathing exercise to help you with anxiety before your treatment. I also really recommend that people reach out for help and accept help. A lot of women are used to being caregivers, and it's difficult for them to accept care from other people, but now is exactly the time that you should do that. So if someone offers to bring you meals or clean your house or give you money to get some takeout, you know, please say yes to that, accept help from all the people who want to do something that they can do to help. If they can't, you know, control your cancer diagnosis, at least they can help you.
And briefly, Kathleen, as we wrap up, if somebody said, hey, what, Kathleen, would you like to see Breast Cancer Awareness Month look like, do more of, less of, what would be your piece of advice for them?
You know, I would love to see it tell more real stories of women who are going through this. I would love to see it raise more money for research so that we can have better treatments for this disease, and to really, you know, continue the awareness of how important screening is. And I think that would be great.
Kathleen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Kathleen Ashton, board-certified clinical health psychologist in the Breast Center, Digestive Disease and Surgery Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. She joined us for a look at the psychological impact of breast cancer. Earlier, we heard from Holly Burns, a breast cancer survivor, who wrote about Breast Cancer Awareness Month for the New York Times and how it can affect, and not always in good ways, it can affect people who are survivors or currently dealing with the disease. Coming up after the news, we welcome Chef Jacques Pepin back for this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk about all the ways he loves to cook and also paint pictures of chicken. He's got a new book with recipes, stories from his career, and a lot of his own artwork. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the town of Peshtigo is suing Marinette manufacturer Tyco and 100 other companies for damages stemming from PFAS water contamination. We'll talk with one resident who's been impacted, learn about a new PFAS mapping tool from the DNR. And we want to hear from you. If this is an issue in your community, if you are trying to deal with PFAS pollutants, let us know what's going on. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Now, our next guest believes a sit-down meal sharing fine food with others might be the pinnacle of civilization. And he spent a lot of time making those meals at home and in restaurants. And he's also spent a lot of time, decades, pursuing another passion, painting. On this week's edition of Food Friday, Jacques Pepin shares the art of cooking and painting chickens. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an all-time favorite chicken recipe? Do you need advice on cooking chicken? Do you raise your own chickens? Love to hear your story. On the off chance, is there anybody out there who likes painting pictures of chickens? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jacques Pepin is a celebrated chef, TV host, author of a lot of books, including Essential Pepin, more than 700 all-time favorites from my life in food. His newest book is called Art of the Chicken, a master chef's paintings, stories, and recipes of the humble bird. Jacques, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was a very glorious introduction of it.
Well, you've had a pretty glorious career, so I think that's pretty fair. Now, I know you cook. I didn't know that you painted. How did you get started painting and painting chickens in particular?
Well, I started painting over 50 years ago. When I came to this country 60 years ago, actually, I have painting from the early 60s, and I was at Columbia. I went to Columbia University here, and at some point, I took a class in sculpture, I think, and drawing. And we had a bunch of friends who had a house in Woodstock, New York, a kind of artist community, so we're all starting redoing all furniture and painting and so forth. So I guess it started there. And then eventually, you know, I was married 54 years, and when people came to our house for over 50 years, we wrote down the menu that we had when we invited people, and they signed on the other page saying funny things and so forth. And I realized that I was illustrating those things very often with chicken, chicken head and so forth. So I started doing more chicken and other panning and so forth. So so that's basically the way it started.
Now, chickens have been really important in your painting career and your cooking career. And you share a lot of stories in this book. And you were a kid in post-war France. Your family started a restaurant. And, you know, things were scarce then. The chicken was a luxury item almost. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, my mother had a small restaurant. We had a few chicken in the, you know, in the backyard that we get them the peel of potato or whatever we didn't eat. And but basically it was for the eggs, certainly as well as the chicken, at least the price. And the chicken occasionally, when my mother killed one, then she would boil it for a long time because it was a whole hand, and boil it and do something with the fat. First, we kept the fat of the chicken, certainly to saute potato or do other things instead of butter. And everything was used, the feet, the head, the liver, the neck, you know, the gizzard, and so forth. So, yes, the chicken in that sense is a very very democratic, maybe the most democratic of all food, because you will find chicken in a truck stop, you know, in a truck food, and as well as in any cafeteria or even in an hospital, but at the same time in a three-star restaurant with the truffle under the skin or whatever. You will find chicken in China, I have, in West Africa, in Turkey, I mean, in India, everywhere I've been in the world, I've had chicken. I don't, this is the, and eggs, certainly. People survive with eggs in a small country, you know, with problems to eat. So, yes, it's a very democratic and universal food.
And Jacques, in your teen years, you're 13, I think, you went to live and apprentice at a restaurant. And you were sent to search for a piece of equipment I never heard of, a chicken boning machine. Can you tell us about that story?
Well, the point is that, you know, you all have rite of passage to go. And I started, I was the youngest apprentice. So that usually they put a prank like that on the youngest apprentice. So the chef, you know, I came into that kitchen. I've never seen a mixer. There was a little mixer. There are a couple of electric equipment that I've never seen, a grounding machine. So the chef told me, you got to get the machine to bone out the chicken at that restaurant, whatever it was in town. So I rushed there to, of course, that was, and the chef told me, oh, wait a minute, we don't have it there. You know, we just sent it to another restaurant, L'Escargot, which was another restaurant 20 minutes out of the way. I think the chef has it there. So I rushed back on the other side. And by then I get there, the chef told me, well, we have the machine, but you better hurry up because your chef is getting mad. You know, you've been gone for a couple of hours and all that. And watch out, we just wash it, so don't bang it too. And he gave me that big thick bag that I had to carry. And I carried and came around the corner where the hotel was that I was in apprenticeship. And I thought they were going to be yelled at. But on the other end, I saw the chefs and the waitress and people on the, you know, by the door, the wedding, and they were all laughing and all that too. That's when I had a doubt, and I opened the bag, which had two big stone in it. I mean, two cement block in it. So that was my rite of passage, you know. So anyway.
We're talking to Chef Jacques Pépin. His new book is called Art of the Chicken, a Master Chef's Paintings, Stories, and Recipes of the Humble Bird. It's got stories, it's got recipes, and it's got his own paintings of chickens over the last 50 years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us in Ashland. Michelle, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I wanted to call in today because I helped my sister put paintings in gift shops, and she paints chickens, and the brighter the color, the faster the chicken will sell out of the gift shop.
Michelle, thanks. Thanks for sharing that, Michelle. Jacques, it's hard to describe pictures out here, but you have a lot of bright colors, some fanciful chickens that are part chicken, part cabbage, things like that. Can you talk about your art and what you're painting a little bit?
Yes, I mean, but as I say, I love chicken. If you look at the back of that book here, I have a picture of me with a chicken on my shoulder, with two chicken on my shoulder. But yes, I do a lot of painting of flowers and even abstract too, but I do a lot of painting, and I got into the habit of doing a chicken who look like a cauliflower or a lettuce or a bunch of leek or whatever. So I kind of mix my cooking and my painting together of chicken, you know. So it's been fun. It's been fun doing it. And actually, I did not want to do a cookbook. And I just wanted to do an art book of my painting of chicken. And the publisher said, fine. But then after, they said, well, we want recipe. And I said, well, I have 30 books of recipe. I don't want recipe. So I have a book called The Apprentice, which I published over 20 years ago, which is a cook's memoir, story of my life. So I did basically the same thing. I start writing story about chicken and about eggs when I was a kid, when I was in Africa, in one place or another, too. And I have some recipe, but those are in the narrative style. I'm sure some of them can be done. But I tell you, my mother used to saute this and that, and chicken, put a bit of this and that, and some. So you probably do it. Some other cannot be done with old style, using a cock's comb and cock's wattle and unborn eggs and sweet bread and pig's feet and so forth. Mm. So those are stories.
A great story I love that you associate a recipe with, a tarragon chicken. Now, you're in this apprenticeship. You're a little older now. You get woken up in the middle of the night. Some customers showed up and the chef wasn't there. And this was your moment to make chicken. Could you talk about the tarragon chicken and how it went?
Right. It was at the Hotel de l'Europe, where I did my apprenticeship in Bourg-en-Bresse, and of course at the center of chicken country. So most of the dish we did in one way or the other were chicken. And one night some guests came from Paris, and around 10 o'clock at night, and the chef had left around 9:30. So the waitress came to my room to knock at the door. All the apprentices slept in a room above the kitchen, and I was the oldest apprentice at the time, even though I was like 15 years old. And they said, well, you have to come down. We have to have there is four people who want to eat. So I rushed to the stove, and fortunately, I still have some coal in the stove. At the time, it was coal and wood. So, and waited what they were going to order. They started by ordering a piece of pâté, which was great because the pâté was made. They just had to slice it, arrange it too. And then after, they wanted a specialty, which was the chicken with the tarragon cream sauce. And it involved, cutting the chicken and sautéing in butter until slightly brown and finishing it with chicken stock and white wine, cooking it for 30 minutes and thicken it with a little bit of flour and butter, and finishing it with cream and tarragon. And I did that as well as I could, and apparently the customer were happy. I was trying to look through the window. I mean, there was the door going to the dining room with a little round window. So, but then the waitress came and said, well, they want to meet the chef. I said, whoa, that was my first exposure. So here came that kid, which was 15 years old, you know, so... as the chef, so that was a bit of a bit of a surprise for them. You know? So anyway, that was my first exposure to celebrity cooking. You know?
We're talking to master chef, TV host, author, and painter Jacques Pépin. It's Food Friday. We're talking about chicken. Jacques' new book is called Art of the Chicken, a master chef's paintings, stories, and recipes of the humble bird. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Jacques about his career making chicken, about his art, or do you need some advice on cooking chicken one way or another? He's done it many ways. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Don't forget the egg. He has some egg recipes too. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with chef, TV host, author, and painter Jacques Pepin. It's Food Friday. We're talking about his latest book, Art of the Chicken, a master chef's paintings, stories, and recipes of the humble bird. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guest, that's 800-642-1234. We've got a caller, Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Oui, bonjour, monsieur.
How are you?
Bonjour, Monsieur Pepin. When I was a little girl, we lived in Brooklyn in New York, and I used to go with my grandmother to get the live chicken. They used to get it and have it killed for them. I wasn't allowed to watch that. But I remember that we used to get the chicken legs and the eggs, you know, the unborn eggs, and put that in the soup. And that made the best. You can't make chicken soup like that anymore, unfortunately.
Oh, Linda.
That was really special.
That's a great memory. Thank you for sharing that, Linda. Jacques, what does that make you think of?
Well, to make me think of my youth also. I used to have the unborn eggs too. You know, those recipes that you have or you eat as a child are very visceral. You know, they stay with you the rest of your life. Whether you come from Turkey, Africa, or China, Italy, or America, you know, whatever your parents or mother cooked, those tastes stay with you forever, you know, and that's what happened there. You know, those memories of food are very strong.
Thank you so much, Linda, for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We got an email. A Grant says, I poach chicken, either thighs or breasts often, but I still struggle to get them to be perfectly moist but not overcooked. Do you have any poaching chicken advice for Grant?
Well, if you poach the whole... See, the leg is going to take a bit longer than the breast, without any question. So if the chicken is whole, I tend to cut between the drumstick and the thigh. I make an incision with the knife so that the heat penetrates there faster, so I don't have to cook it as long for the leg to be totally cooked and not to overcook the breast. So it's very important, too. I mean, I have a recipe. I think I have it in that book, given to me by Danny Kaye, the famous actor, you know, Danny Kaye.
Oh, yeah.
I cook with him at his house. One time I came there and he said, I'm going to show you how to do a poached chicken, a chicken salad. So he took a chicken and he opened his drawer and took a handful of spoon, fork, and stuffed it inside and dropped it in the stock pot. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm putting that in there so that the chicken doesn't come to the top. Then he covered it with water. And salt, pepper, he put a lick in it, whatever, and bring it to a boil. And he boiled it maybe 3 minutes, 3-4 minutes, that's it. And he covered it and leave it on the side for 1 hour. Now, I have done that, and I think I mentioned that recipe in there. And you don't need to put the fork and spoon into the chicken to keep it in the bottom of the pan. But cooking it very briefly like this and leaving it in that hot broth for 1 hour, it produced a very, very moist chicken, yes. And so we shredded it out after to do a chicken salad. It was really good.
And you write in the book, fairly early on, the way a chicken is raised, actually you say makes a big difference in the quality of both the meat of the chicken and the eggs. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, of course. A free-range chicken is a happy chicken, eating grass, eating worm, going around. And that's no comparison with a chicken which is raised in a closed enclosure and eat only when the sound is atrocious. In addition, there is thousands of chicken. They kind of blind the chicken so that they don't kill one another to fight. And they put light on there because, as you know, a chicken, when the cock starts cockering in the morning, you know, and that's when the chicken wake up, and that's when they do an egg during the day. Well, because of the light. When there is no light, there is no egg. So in those places, they put light on top of the chicken so they can do two eggs a day instead of one. When you torture Mother Nature this way, you know, there is no way you're going to get great quality. So I would always advise people to buy organic eggs now. Frankly, it's not very expensive. It's a bit more expensive than the regular one, but when you break it down to pair eggs, it doesn't cost you more than like 40 or 50 cents for an egg. So, yes, it's important to And for the quality of life of animal too, it's important not to torture those animals, you know.
Talking to Jacques Pepin on this edition of Food Friday. His new book is called Art of the Chicken, A Master Chef's Paintings, Stories and Recipes of the Humble Bird. Got a lot of his own paintings and artwork, plus his stories, and of course, some recipes along the way. Jacques, you were just talking about eggs. Now, one of your stories here, I didn't know this, when you would have to go and audition and try to get a job at a new restaurant, very often what people would ask you to make was an omelet. Why an omelet?
Yeah, well, the classic omelet, you know, there is different way of doing omelet. I do at least four different types of omelet. But the classic French omelet that I do, where you move the eggs very fast, so that they are scrambled, like very, very finely scrambled, and you don't even let it brown, and you roll the omelet itself. It requires quite a lot of technique on a classic French cooking. So that's what a test, you know, when you work in restaurants in Paris, the chef will argue and say, why don't you make an omelette just to see how proficient you were with your skill. You know, so that's what a test.
Now, I'm never going to work in a French restaurant. What is the best way for a home cook to get a really good omelette?
Well, as I said, if you do the conventional omelette that you have in a cafeteria or diner, where you put the egg into hot butter and you stir them occasionally. You have large lumps too, and eventually you fold it in half and put it on a plate. You may fold it in half when it's still wet in the center or totally dry. It depends entirely on your own taste. Now, the classic French omelette is mixed, as I say, very fast, and it's very creamy inside, and it's not brown. There is no harsh curd. So it is different. It has a different taste. Is it better than the conventional omelette? Not really. It's just different. Some people will like one better than the other. And sometimes I'm in the mood for one. Sometimes I'm in the mood for the other.
Do you still paint chickens even after 50 years?
I still paint chickens. Yes, absolutely. I painted, I think, a couple last week. Yes, I did.
Now, I want to bring this home. You write about this at the outset. There's creativity, of course, in painting, and there's creativity in cooking and in the kitchen. So that can you talk about how that's kind of a natural pairing for you to cook and paint?
Yes, it's a different type of thing, but certainly as a professional chef, and I've been a professional chef for over 75 years, so in the kitchen, when you are behind the stove and you have an order for you know, a chicken sauté with the mushroom, whatever. Well, you don't have a recipe or whatever. You have the recipe that you do in that particular restaurant and all that in your head, and you start cooking it. If someone was behind you taking note exactly what you're doing, okay, 10 minutes later, you have another order for the same chicken. And let's say you do it 10 or 12 times during the evening, the same order of chicken. If someone who write those behind you yourself, you would realize that you haven't done it one exactly the same way. The idea is that, however, it come out the same way. It come out, the taste is exactly the same at the end, because as you start cooking, maybe the chicken breast is slightly thicker than the other, or the hot, or the pan is hotter, or whatever. It gets a little dry, so I put a tablespoon of water, which I may not do the next time. I do that. So the question is to cook, taste, adjust, and eventually that's in the end. Okay. So the reaction is always slightly different. You know, so there is that type of very personal interpretation in the cooking. And it's the same thing in painting, you know. So in painting, at some point you paint a bunch of flowers and the painting kind of take a hold of you and you react to it and you put that color there or that shape there, you react to it and so forth. So there are similarities like that, some very intuitive type of thing.
Jacques, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's Jacques Pepin, celebrated chef, TV host, painter, and author of a bunch of books, including the one we talked about today on this edition of Food Friday. It's called Art of the Chicken, A Master Chef's Paintings, Stories, and Recipes of the Humble Bird. Still time for you to share your stories, maybe your own art, if you have chicken-related art that you produce yourself, or maybe a cherished item up on a wall. Share it on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, check out a new effort here in Wisconsin aimed at helping families and kids in particular to overcome barriers and achieve success in the educational system, sometimes including families that have dealt with incarceration and the challenges that raises for kids going to school. Join the conversation. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, I mentioned a conversation we had about doing things that we're bad at and that I had tried it lately by singing, which I am bad at. Well, here's another thing I am also bad at. Earlier today, I texted former Central Time producer Judith Sears Poisson. You may remember her. She was on the show a lot. She speaks French, by the way. I told her that Jacques Pepin was going to be on the show today. Her reply, quote, "Yes, I heard. Please don't try to say anything in French." Harsh, but fair, because I'm very bad at pronouncing French words. Now, for this job, I often have to say words or names or place names from languages that I don't speak, which is most of them. When it happens, I try to study up, then I give it my best shot. I think I mostly do okay. And then there's French. Doesn't come up that often, except on Food Friday, even if I'm not talking to a famous French chef. A lot of the words for techniques and equipment are French words. Judith tried her best to coach me, but here we are. I don't know what it is. I can't wrap my brain around it. I guess it's just some kind of je ne sais quoi. Sorry, Judith. This is Central Time.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.